Oilers. We're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to a very special post-NFL trade deadline episode of Battle Red Radio, where we'll talk about that and we'll answer some of your listener questions left over from last week's game after the Texans-Rams game, as well as your listener questions after the NFL trade deadline. But to recap the trade deadline, nothing really happened today. Melvin Ingram was traded from the Steelers to the Chiefs after he was upset about the amount of playing time that he had. And the Texans traded Charles Omenihu to the San Francisco 49ers for not a 2022 sixth-round pick, but a 2023 sixth-round pick, which beats out a 2024 seventh-round pick that they received from Mark Ingram. And I think this trade deadline is really indicative of, you know, like a lot of the problems with the Texans this past offseason this year, where it was obvious that it was time for a full rebuild, to pull the plug on everything, to start anew, and instead they were stagnant and decided to opt more to fix the culture of the team, you know, turn the bottom half of the roster, create some idea of competition, whereas at the same time they just handed out jobs to friends of theirs like Rex Burkhead and Danny Amendola, and those sorts of things. But by turning the roster, the idea was that, well, if we sign these guys, they'll have a good season for us, and if we're bad, we can only slip them for draft picks, or it can factor into our comp picks of next year. And, you know, like a lot of these guys have just been, you know, terrible this year. They've been bad in a bad defensive scheme. They haven't made an impact at all, and they've also been playing out position. And so, like, you have these guys who signed with Houston to be able to kind of resurrect their careers and be insured a good chunk of playing time. Like Desmond King, who didn't play at all last week. He moved from a slot corner who's good in zone coverage to an outside corner. He's been terrible. You know, since the Buffalo game, he's been benched there for, you know, Vernon Hargreaves and Terrace Mitchell. You see Charles Omenihu, who was traded, who is an interior pass rusher, who's moved to the exterior, who really hasn't done anything at all at that spot because he doesn't have the speed to bend the edge. And against tackles with longer arms, too, like his arm length, his rushes, his long arms, his rips, they don't work as well either. You know, from that position too. And you have, you know, Tyus Howard playing at left guard instead of right tackle. You have Justin Reed having played strong safety now because Lonnie Johnson Jr. is not playing free safety. Terrence Mitchell had a bad game last week. And so you have these guys that you signed, and rather than just like signing good players or signing young players with the upside of some sort of like future potential, which doesn't exist with a player like, you know, Desmond King, they sign these older veterans. And not only have they been, you know, out of spots in a lot of these places, but they just haven't performed very well. And so if you sign bad players, this is what happens, you know? You don't get anything for bad players to be traded at the trade deadline if you're not making moves at all. And so I'm not really, I don't know, I'm surprised they didn't cut bait with more players that maybe they could have got something for, like Malik Collins or Justin Reed even, if he's not part of their future plans at all. Brandon Cooks, you kind of thought, but it seems like they kind of talked him into, you know, staying here for the long term. And I also think, too, if they trade Brandon Cooks this year, they might as well just forfeit it because he's the entire of their passing offense. But it just kind of goes back to show, like, Nick Casario had a bad offseason. This idea of, like, signing veterans so you could flip didn't work out at all because the veterans are bad and you're not going to trade, like, a fifth-round pick for Terrence Mitchell whenever he can't play man coverage at all whatsoever. And you're not going to trade a, you know, fourth-round pick for Desmond King whenever he's been completely out of position, even if you are a zone heavy defense as well too. And so it kind of left Houston just kind of stuck, you know. And, you know, you would think for a 1-7 team, a rebuilding team needs draft capital, there'd be more of a fire sale, but the fire sale didn't exist. They were, you know, really just kind of a bad spot. And I guess I'll just say it again for one more time. When you have bad players, teams aren't going to trade much for them at all. And regardless of what your idealistic ideas were this past spring, they failed, they didn't work out, and now the Texans are going to go into next season, turn out the bottom half of their roster again, but hopefully at least this time they'll trade down the draft, collect more draft picks, cast a wide UDFA net, sign younger players with some potential as well too, and actually kind of go all in on this rebuild. And obviously the Deshaun Watson trade will take precedence to that too. Watson was in trade today, and I'm glad to see that. You know, if you're not going to get the haul that you need to make it worthy trading him, there's no reason to do so. The Texans are better off paying him not to play than, you know, making a quick decision for him to go somewhere where you're not getting what he's worth at all whatsoever. And I also think, too, like, after another year, you know, we're 9 more weeks away from the season being over, more teams are going to be desperate for quarterback play. And it happens every year. It's going to happen again next season. I also think, too, with Watson having to sit out for an entire year, he'll be more apt to accepting a trade to a different team instead of it just being Miami, Miami, Miami. And so I think it opens the door for the Broncos or the Giants or, you know, a team like that for him to want to maybe make a move as well next season too. So I think they'll be able to get a better offer next year than they were able to get this year. I think the court stuff will be cleared up hopefully a little bit more by then too, to kind of have a better idea what, you know, could come with that in the future too. But I am, like, glad that Nick Casario didn't make a quick decision, that they didn't trade him to Miami for, you know, the Niners' first-round pick, 2 first-round picks in 2023, and Salvin Ahmed instead of Myles Gaskin. So at least that didn't happen. So going here to the listener questions, the first one's from at Shandy Ben, and he asked, what is the best indication of how well the new culture building is going? The empty seats, the 7th consecutive loss, Desmond King being a healthy scratch for disciplinary reasons, Brandon Cooks' Twitter, or other? I'm going to go with the empty seats, and it really is. It's kind of one of those things, like some of the stuff you can kind of, you know, block out. Like even for a bad team who loses 7 games in a row, they can at least say, like, well, you know, we're rebuilding, we're going through, you know, rust patch, this will be better in the future. You know, this is just the adversity that we have to overcome for a good football team. Desmond King, healthy scratch. I guess it was for disciplinary reasons. He missed a team activity, so I guess King didn't want to go to the team barbecue this weekend, and that's why he was a healthy scratch last week. But he hasn't been very good. And the Texans played a lot of cover 3 last week. They play a lot of cover one man. They play a lot of coverages where he's been bad in those positions too. So they didn't really miss him very much as well either. You know, Cooks' Twitter, he said during the telecast, I guess, that, or his announcers during the telecast, they talked to the Texans front office. After they traded Mark Ingram, he came back around to it. And he also stated that, well, you know, I watched the Warriors rebuild, and it'd be very special to be a part of something where we go from the bottom to building something good again. So I hope Cooks is able to be there whenever that happens in the next, you know, 2 or 3 years, however long it takes. If Nick Casario is able to, you nail the Watson trade, the draft capital goes along with it, the players they select with it, and be able to make the Texans a good team again before Brandon Cooks is, you know, 34 years old. But I think the biggest thing about the empty seats, though, is like you can't turn that off. Like if you're the owner of the team and you look around and nobody cares and nobody's, you know, the whole stadium is parse. It looks like a yard for a new subdivision, you know, before the grass seeds will be laid down. And the only stuff that's there actually, you know, weeds in there and a lot more of the other team's fans too. You can't turn that off. Like it's there, it's visible, it's right in front of your face. And so I think of all the things this year, just the empty seats is the best indication of the culture where the team has been. And like Cal McNair can turn his cell phone off. He can not, you know, sign a Twitter if he has a Twitter, which I hope he doesn't. But whenever he's at the game itself, he can't turn off the empty seats. Our next question is from at Confused Lefty. He said, the team goes 1-16, would David Coley be fired? You know, I think it's in play. And like, I think a lot of stuff with Coley too, you know, he's been so bad this year in like really basic spots of the head coaching position, you know, just from not taking penalties when they should, to not going for it when they should, to kicking field goals when they shouldn't, and everything else. And he just looks like he's in the middle of the trenches at the Somme whenever he's there on the sideline chewing his gum and frantically, you know, looking around too. But I guess the idea is like, if you're Houston, if you cut Coley, if you fire him, like, will a good head coach want to come here? You know, would a good head coach want to be like, well, there's only 16 of these things. I'll subject myself to, you know, whatever Casario and ESPN want to do roster-wise, not have a whole lot of impact in that and stay here. And, you know, that's kind of the big question. It's like, if you fire him, are you going to get somebody with like any sort of caliber at all that could work in Houston and build the next good team here? And maybe Coley was just here for like a one-off season to keep morale high. And that's kind of the question. But I do think like it'd be worth it to fire Coley. Like, I love him. He's a beautiful man. He loves nachos. And I love David Coley more than he loves nachos. But he's just been so far like out of his mind trying to run this football team. It just hasn't worked out very well at all either. I think you kind of have to cut bait if you are 1-16. And it'd be different if they were 1-16 without these like elementary issues, and they keep happening over and over again. And your offensive scheme is good, and your defensive scheme is good, but you're losing close games, and the talent's there, whatever else. And it isn't. It's not like they're losing games like the Lions have this season. They're just getting stomped with David Mills at the quarterback position. They haven't done much to help him out there either. His next question is, if you had to keep one secondary player from this season to start next season, would it be Lonnie Johnson Jr. or Vernon Hargraves? I think at this point, I would have to go Vernon Hargraves, because at least like he's quiet about it. Like, Hargraves is bad, but at least he's like just kind of bad and noble about it. Like, watching Lonnie Johnson Jr. make a tackle on an 18-yard gain and get in the other player's face and, look around and everything, like, it's just kind of sickening. He missed 5 tackles last week. He failed to stay on top of a deep post route in Houston with Vernon Hargraves and that deep reception that Van Jefferson had last week too. And, he has that Tyrann Mathieu brain, where he's punching at the ball instead of going for tackles and letting the guy carry him and then get mad whenever he gets pushed around. He gets mad when somebody gets blocks him to the whistle. He gets upset, whenever he misses a tackle like 25 yards down the field. He yells at his teammates whenever it's obviously on him making mistakes in coverage too. And so at least Hargraves is like kind of quiet about it. And if they're going to be bad anyways, I can't believe I'm saying this. I think I'd rather watch Hargraves, and we know like Johnson Jr., like I've been talking about him since he was drafted in 18. Like, he was a bad cornerback in Kentucky. He's been a bad cornerback in Houston. He's been a bad safety here too. And there's like not really anywhere else to put him. And I was kind of hoping that if Houston did play a cover 2 or cover 3 defense like they've been playing this year, that they would give him a chance at corner again, where he could kind of be physical, where he could press receivers to the line of scrimmage. And even then, they haven't even given him a chance to do that. So I don't know where else they're going to put him at all going forward. The next question is, which performance is worse this season, Buffalo or Los Angeles? And I would say for Davis Mills, it was Buffalo. For the offensive line, it was Buffalo. Josh Allen was like, he made like 3 really good throws and really kind of picked on Lonnie Johnson Jr. against Buffalo. But I guess I'd say the LA game, because the thing about the LA game is they didn't force any turnovers. And also, like, the Rams really didn't do anything like crazy, like as far as like their, like the plays they made. They were just smarter than Houston. If you just watch their run game, just like how many times the cutback was open against them, how many times they're able to just bounce outside and there is 2 defenders in the same gap and there is nobody there to keep contained at all. Offensively, their run offense was awful. They ran like 8 different run plays and they couldn't block either of them, any of them at all. They kept trying to run screen passes that don't work at all. They tried to run that quick boot and it was nearly picked off by Jalen Ramsey. The only play they really hit on at all was, 2 plays on play action, which has been kind of a given, where they were able to hit Collins off of Nico Collins off a deep in off play action and get that slam before the half too. But it was just putrescent. And like, at least against Buffalo, like, it was windy and it was rainy and the weather was bad. You can point to some of that, but this one, like, at home indoors, and to just like get beat by like the pocket being collapsed and Phillip Gaines just wrecking your entire defense. Like, it wasn't even Aaron Donald. It wasn't even Leonard Floyd. It was Phillip Gaines that was crushing against Justin McCray. And so, like, that's, I think, the biggest difference. I'd say the performance against Los Angeles was worse this week. The next question from him is, if Tygod Taylor wasn't due to come back next week, would Davis Mills be close to being benched for the 3rd choice? So, I still don't even, like, even if Taylor is healthy, I don't really see the point in playing him. Like, you may win 2 or 3 more games and you're playing him just for like pride's sake, so that way you beat the Jets. But if you beat the Jets, it hurts your draft position. Or if you beat the Jaguars, it hurts your draft position. And like, it really doesn't matter. Like, Tyrod Taylor shouldn't be in your future plans at quarterback unless you draft a rookie early this year. And, you know, you want to, you kind of go through the same thing all over again, except it's a first round pick next time. But, like, I'd rather just have Davis Mills be out there. And, like, I know the Texans are unwatchable. I know Davis Mills has been bad. But at least, like, and I think Davis Mills is bad. You know, like, I understand there's some problems with the offense and everything else, but the same players with Tyrod Taylor were able to be, you know, able to score points against Jacksonville and keep it close against Cleveland the first half. The same players to Davis Mills haven't been anywhere close to them. The Texans are now 31st in offensive DVOA, 32nd in, you know, run offense DVOA too. And so I think even if, despite all that, I think even if Taylor is healthy, you're better off just playing Mills and at least being able to make a decision for next year saying, look, he's not it. We'll keep him here as a backup. We'll keep him here as a third string developmental quarterback. But we're going to roll with, you know, rookie quarterback X. We're going to roll with a different veteran, or because Tyrod Taylor can't stay healthy enough at all. So if you do keep Taylor as your starting quarterback, you're going to do the same thing all over again next year. So I think that'd be a better plan, at least giving like the kid a chance to have more chances to fail out there. So you can't really, you know, what you're going to get into next year. And so I kind of said this offseason too, like I was hoping we'd see like 8 starts from Davis Mills this year, because you can't really glitter a turd of 8 starts. And so we've seen 7 from him so far this year, or I guess we've seen 6 from him so far this year, and he's been awful in all of them except for the New England game where he made 3 throws. He hasn't made, you know, again this year too. So I would rather watch Mills out here than watch Ty God though. The next question is from at Father's House, Texas. What happens if Watson gets an indictment from the grand jury? We get nothing for him. Texan story could get worse. There are doomsday scenarios because this organization is a mess. And I don't really know what would happen if he was indicted, you know, by a grand jury. I don't know enough about the legal portion of it. I don't know exactly what would occur. And even if like the civil case is enough where he loses his civil cases, I don't know what would happen if that happened as well too. It's kind of a weird thing where like you're trying to balance a future thing that nobody knows anything really at all about. How the NFL's investigation process is going to go, because it's separate from the legal process, and then even how the legal process is going to go, and what would happen if, you know, Watson settles this outside the court too. So I don't know, but there are cases where, yeah, like this could happen where Houston doesn't trade Watson at all, despite being like the right move at the moment to hold off until next offseason, and then he gets suspended, and then they're not able to really get anything at all for him. In a way, maybe you get like a second round pick for him 2 years from now because he's been suspended for a year. And like that's in the realm of possibilities. And, you know, as we always say on the show, like every time you think there's a bottom, it can get deeper. And I think Watson being suspended for like a year or something and crushing all of Houston's trade value of him would be probably about as deep as it can go too. Our next question is from a good friend of mine, Greg. He asked, question for the mailbag. Would you rather see this FO draft your next quarterback or acquire one via trade? Is the loss of a quarterback rookie contract worth it to minimize the risk of the front office making another bad drafting mistake? You know, and this is a great question. And I think the biggest thing about this is like, it depends on where you're at. You know, I think you're better off trading for a veteran quarterback if you have other parts set up. You know, like what we saw with the Rams trading for Stafford last year, and the Colts trading for Wentz this year, and trading for, and then gave Philip Rivers the year before that. Like, if I think trading for a veteran quarterback makes more sense, or like a young, like, current quarterback who's had some problems, only if, like, you have pieces around there too. Because you're getting a guy who's either, like, failed in some sense before, or you're trying to make a playoff push, you know? And so, like, if the Texans were to trade Garoppolo, they'd still have an awful offense next year. If the Texans were to trade for, I don't know, Kirk Cousins or Baker Mayfield, they still have a terrible offense next year. You know, they don't really have the talent around it to be able to help like a borderline like franchise quarterback be able to have a really good offense just because the talent isn't here at all. And so like a lot of quarterbacks you get in a trade, they usually have a lot of, you know, things that go along with that, whether it's age, whether it's durability, whether it's a lack of mobility, whether it's a lack of big play throwing ability, they kind of hamper him from that. And so without having other pieces in play, you're kind of just treading water if you are to, you know, trade for a quarterback. But like that being said too, like if you do miss on a quarterback, then you have to go through the same thing, you know, 3 years later, or you're using another top draft pick on a quarterback, and then you're just kind of the hamster wheel over and over again hoping that you finally, you know, find one. But the worst, you know, case scenario is what the Texans went through last decade, where you kind of plow through veteran quarterbacks and you try to convince yourself you don't need one. And then you go all in on one in free agency and it doesn't work out. And then you eventually trade for Watson. That was, you know, what really kind of changed him around last decade. But I think just like going through bad quarterbacks is worse. And also having a quarterback who's like below average that you keep sticking with, that you try to convince yourself into being that quarterback, it's probably the worst case scenario. And so like we saw it happen in San Francisco, and they decided to try and get Trey Lance, who's been, you know, really bad this year. We saw that with the Rams and Jared Goff, who they were able to turn him into Matthew Stafford. We're kind of seeing right now the Cleveland Baker Mayfield. I think to a certain extent we saw it Kirk Cousins, but Kirk Cousins is now, you know, underrated at the moment. And like with Cousins, it was more about, well, they turned Case Keenum into him, paid him the big contract, lost some defensive players to go along with that, and they were set up right away. But he was just so bad against pressure and was able to create anything on his own that they, you know, missed the playoffs the year after that happened too. So I do think the Texans are a spot where trading for a quarterback doesn't make much sense. Signing a veteran quarterback, you know, makes sense as a stopgap. But, you know, I think that you have to take a quarterback early on next year. And like, even if you don't, unless you like, obviously there's not one that you love or whatever. But I think if you have, you know, two top 10 picks, you have to take a quarterback and maybe make your first pick the defensive from Oregon or the corner from LSU or whatever. But if you take a quarterback, then that spot, at least like you have a shot at it, and then you kind of know what you can do going forward with it, and then you kind of get off of it in a year or two if you need to. But I think general managers are kind of hesitant now, too, to take quarterbacks unless they like are all in on love them, because if you miss up on the quarterback position early on the draft, like that's what you're kind of staking your entire, you know, career to, and GMs usually don't get multiple chances. And so for Caserio, he's staking his career to the Watson trade, and then after that, he's doubled down on a quarterback. And those are two big decisions to make too. But if you decide not to take one early next year and you rebuild and you take a bunch of top talent early in the draft, maybe it all works out and you have like an okay team going into that year. And then all of a sudden you're picking 12th or you're picking 8th. And now you're outside the bubble getting the quarterback that you want. And now you trade up more draft capital to get one. And you're kind of stuck there too. So I'm always in the mindset that if you're able to take one high and you need one, there's one you like, you should do it. Even if the quarterback you like is only, you like him a little bit less than the offensive tackle that's available, you should take the quarterback. And so I think for the Texans with a quarterback class, it's like 7 guys deep that nobody really feels strongly about just yet. I think going into it at the moment, like you'd still look to take one next year at a minimum, and that'd be better than, you know, taking somebody else. But I think going along with what he's saying too about the current front office, trust him to take a quarterback. You know, it's a valid point. Like Nick Caserio, the quarterbacks they took when he was in New England were Garoppolo, who's bad, Brissett, who's bad. And Mac Jones has been like what I think Davis Mills' ceiling is. You know, currently at the moment is like a rookie year. Mac Jones, he's been able to like win with his mind, and he's like an accurate passer, gets the ball out quickly, but he wasn't even part of that, you know, decision to take Mac Jones this year too. And so I really don't even like Nick Caserio's track record from a personnel standpoint either. You know, it's not like the Patriots have been some incredible drafters the past 3 or 4 years. That team was pretty talentless whenever Tom Brady left it. And we kind of saw that last year watching Cam Newton quarterback them and even watching Brian Hoyer quarterback them a few times too. So, yeah, I think like what you can expect from Caserio is kind of part of it. But I think you still have to take one regardless of that. And, you know, Caserio has a lot to prove right now, considering his offseason last year, where he came from, New England, and just what the Patriots looked like before he left too. Our next question is from @ConfusedLefty, and he asks, what will it take for Nick to regain your confidence as our general manager going forward? And I think the first thing is, like, not trading Watson makes me feel, you know, good because it was the right decision to make, holding on to him instead of, you know, making a quick deal because Kyle McNair is uncomfortable or the Dolphins want this move made right now or the NFL is putting pressure on him to get rid of Watson or whatever else. Just like it was the right decision not to move him today. And so like, that gives me more confidence going forward. But like really it just kind of comes down to having like a cohesive plan and signing good players. And you know, last year he didn't have a cohesive plan. The contract restructures were insane. I still think the decision to sign all the veterans they did was crazy as well too. I didn't really see the point of the season aside from to fast forward through and see what you would get for Watson. going into it as well. And yeah, like it just kind of comes down to taking good players and having like a unified strategy. And so like right now, the Texans don't have any cornerstone players at the moment. Like, I mean, I guess you'd say Laremy Tunsil, but the Texans are better off trading him than keeping him. But all across the roster on both sides of the ball, there's not a cornerstone player there at all. And so they really are just kind of like an expansion team at the moment that need to completely restart everything. And, you know, again, if they have three top 10 picks in the first round next year, that's a great jumping off point. And if they hit those picks, then maybe they can be good by 2024 instead of at the end of this decade too. So, you know, it's kind of simple. Football is very complicated, but sometimes it can be simple. Have a cohesive plan, take good players, and you know that's what matters. The next question here is from @HoustonDiehards. What is the prey route going to be for Caserio, who is being lauded as great for doing the obvious thing? Should his statue be 750 feet tall or 1,000 feet tall? I love this, especially because you're just bouncing off the previous question of, you know, what would it take for Caserio to give me some more faith in him? And it was keeping Watson. And, you know, as Chris joked around, like, yeah, that is the bare minimum. Like, that's where we're at right now, where the bare minimum is just don't do the dumbest thing in the world, which is trade Watson before you should do it. And so now going off of that, like, I'm glad they didn't do it. And yeah, I think I don't think he should have a statue built because those things are too permanent. But I do think we should all wear electric blue sweater vests on Friday in congratulations for Nick Caserio for doing the very obvious thing at the trade deadline. Our next question is from @SmoothGrandmama. I'm going to say it's @SmoothGrandma. I don't like @SmoothGrandmama very much. Or @SmoothGrandmama. I don't know. Which young player stands to gain the most bent from veteran? Check notes. Charles Manahu being traded away. Bill O'Brien. So for this question, it's weird because Manahu was benched earlier in the year and he wasn't really rushing the interior at his good spot. You know, last week they played him at defensive end and he had a lot of awful stunts, like really clunky. Some gross stunts where he really wasn't going anywhere. He did slant side of a gap and almost make a tackle for a loss on Sony Michel. But then Michelle carried him for 3 yards on 2nd and 3 to convert anyways. He had like a all right swim move that created pass pressure, but didn't get to the quarterback either. But now that he's not playing on the edge at all, it just means that you're going to see more Jacob Martin, who was awful last week, who needs to be playing for a 3-4 defense as soon as possible. And I guarantee you that Jacob Martin's going to end up signing with Carolina next year to replace Hassan Reddick in free agency. Once he signs a big money contract someplace else, it leads to more snaps for Jonathan Greenard, but it also leads to more snaps for Jenkins at defensive end. It leads to, you know, more snaps for DeMarcus Walker playing more out there after he's played a lot of defensive tackle this year too. But yeah, it's kind of slim at those spots, but Omenihu wasn't playing a whole lot at the moment and he's playing mainly on the exterior too. So I think it just leads to Yeah, Greenard and Martin are our edge defenders for the rest of the year, and we'll see what they can do at it. But yeah, next time you watch the Texans play, watch Martin whenever he's on the strong side of the formation, playing the 6 technique, and it's rough. It's some of the most rough football you'll see for a 245-pound guy having to play against double teams and trade blocks against tackles and tight ends where he just gets crushed pretty easily there. His next question is, Bill O'Brien once traded away a 7th-round pick for a future 6th. Outside the Roby trade, has Caserio gotten more value than that out of any trade? this is really funny, too. I don't remember whenever O'Brien traded away the 7th-round pick for a future 6th, but yeah, that was kind of what I was talking about this year, too, with Caserio, because it's not like he created a whole lot of draft capital this year, and the draft capital isn't a balanced ledger. You know, you're not trying to even out to have 7 picks every year. It's okay. You can have more picks than you're selected to have going into the draft. You know, you can have 13 picks. You can have 17 picks. There's no limit to the number of draft picks that you can have. And so, what he did was he turned Bernardo McKinney into Shaq Lawson and turned Shaq Lawson into a 6th-round pick. He turned Randall Cobb into a 6th-round pick. He turned Whitney Merciless into a 6th-round pick. He turned Bradley Roby into a 3rd-round pick and then a 6th-round pick. He turned Manahu into a future 6th-round pick. He turned Mark Ingram into a seventh round pick. He made a trade for Anthony Miller. He made a trade for Marcus Cann. That was pretty much a pick swap. He traded for Ryan Izzo. He traded for Ryan Finley. So like he ended up with more picks pulled in than he put out. But still, some of the decisions that he made, push picks out, didn't make all that much sense either as well too. But yeah, going back to this one, I mean, the Roby trade, he made it because they did have King and Hargraves and Mitchell on the roster, and they've all been bad this year. But like for like a lost season or whatever, if you're going to get third round pick for Roby before the year, before you have a down season, like that was a good trade. And it kind of signified like, hey, we're not going to be good. We're rebuilding. But it was like the only move he did that. And by the time he did it, it was already after the entire offseason. So it didn't match up very well. But yeah, I'm going to go with no on this one. And if it'd be different if he didn't restructure Winnie Merciless and he didn't restructure Shaq Lawson before trading him, because those, they don't really acquire any cap space next year by making those trades. And I would say Randall Cobb maybe, but Cobb was traded because the Packers were dying to have him because Aaron Rodgers loves Randall Cobb, and Cobb's been, you know, all right for the Packers so far this year. The next question is from King Jamie, and his Twitter handle is at JM. His Twitter handle is at J4ML1N. And he said, if we lived in a vacuum where baseball didn't exist, where would Davis and Nate Mills rank in most exciting players to watch in Houston? Well, I don't know much about the basketball team either, but I think of all the players the Texans have to watch on the excitement level, I would put him... I put him around Charlie Heck. I probably actually put him lower than Charlie Heck. Because Charlie Heck's fine. He's a really bad run blocker, but he's okay in pass protection. I don't know. I think I put Davis Mills last. Like all of his throws last week were in garbage time against backup players, and they're just running like the same five routes over and over again that he's able to throw, and that's it. And the run game's so bad too, and they don't check any plays the other direction. They don't make any audibles to the line of scrimmage at all. They're running in big boxes, can't block everybody. And, you know, he really has, like, the Taylor was kind of making the Texans, like, a feel-good hit, but it was still Nick Caserio's fault. They didn't have a backup plan for him. But Davis Mills has made the Texans unwatchable. So I'm going to say he's last. Davis Mills is the most boring player to watch in the city of Houston right now. And I don't see it getting any better, too, as the year goes on. Our next question is from at found of HOU Sports. Is Mark Ingram still invited to the David Culley cookout after we go 2-15? And this is also saying that they're going to beat Mike White and the New York Jets. And, you know, we don't know if that's going to happen either now. But yeah, I think so. You know, this is a family. The Texans are more than a football team. They're a family. They love each other. They care a lot about each other. And, you know, you heard David Culley talking to Mark Ingram earlier this year. On the sideline, he said, we love you. We're so glad we have you in this team. You know, we need you here. And Ingram said, love you too, coach. And now there he is in New Orleans where he can love Champagne. He can fall back and love a Champagne again too. But yeah, I think Mark Ingram will be there after they go 2-15. Now, I don't know if Charles Amenihu will be there. I don't know if Randall Cobb will be there. I don't know if Shaq Lawson will be there. But definitely Mark Ingram will be there. His next question is, also, how many Hail Marys for Cooks and Lonnie for using curse words on Twitter? Lonnie Johnson Jr. said a derogatory comment to John McClain saying he looked like the KFC Colonel, which was, you know, rude. And then Cooks, you know, said the S-H-I-T word after the Texans traded, after they went ahead and traded Mark Ingram to the New Orleans Saints. And, I mean, I guess they're Christian, so they're not really Catholic. So I guess they don't do that. You know, I guess the punishment is more... I mean, I guess they have to pray a lot, you know, and really, really think hard on the mistakes they made to feel better after making poor decisions like this. Yeah, if this was a Catholic team, I think 15 would be good. You know, I think 15, and then I think every single time they reflected back and had that same thought like that, it would be another 15 so they can push those wicked, evil thoughts out of their head too. And so our last question from tonight is from member of the masthead at Houston Houdini. And he asked, this team is a known commodity. With the draft seemingly being a mixed bag of quarterbacks, Mills establishing what he is, and Ty God's uncertainty, what kind of team are you hoping to see next year make games watchable? Yeah, I mean, this is a great question too, and you know, this is why we do this. You guys have incredible questions. I think for the Texans next year, like, the one thing that's been driving me insane is somebody who loves offensive line play and just watching the offensive line. Like, I just want to watch a Texans team with a good offensive line again. It's been since 2015 when the Texans had a good offensive line. Ben Jones has been in Tennessee since then. Brandon Brooks has been all pro since then, and his career is kind of coming to an end because of injury history after tearing his pectoral again this year, after tearing his knee the year before that. Derek Noonan's no longer in the NFL. Dwayne Brown's still kicking it. Xavier Suafield has played for both Dallas and Cincinnati since then, and is on, I guess, team number 3 at the moment since he played for Houston too. And so I just want to watch an offensive line that's good. And I'm so tired of watching them run, you know, split outside zone, having not work, and pulling Jordan Akins to the backside, but having it not matter at all whatsoever, because nobody cares about Jordan Akins. Nobody cares that he may leak out into the flat and may break one tackle and gain 3 yards after the catch. I'm so tired of watching them, you know, run outside zone and help back on the defensive tackle instead of, you know, taking actual zone steps and get to the second level. I'm tired of watching these double teams that don't move anybody in the first level at all. I'm tired of people pulling without any sort of, like, violence at the point of attack and just kind of, like, flopping into them and sitting there. I'm tired of these, like, awful, awful angles they take at the second level as well, too. And pass protection is the same thing. Like, they just have problems picking up blitzes. And Jaron Christian was fine last week. And Charlie Heck was pretty good. He missed Leonard Floyd once on like a leaping chop rip that where he showed his hands too early. They gave a sack, but most of the pressure came on the interior. It mainly came from Phillip Gaines just working, you know, Justin McCray throughout them, the interior. Aaron Donald had a big beat on Sharping for another sack too. But I just want to watch this team that's fun to watch in the offensive line and like get rid of everybody, you know? Like, I don't want to watch any of them. Trey Laramie Tunsil, you know, Justin Britt's hurt again, and which was expected after a guy who's been hurt the last 2 years. You know, release him, release Max Sharping, or try to trade him for a future sixth-round pick if you can. Give us a 2025 sixth-round pick for Max Sharping. And, you know, Tyus Howard blocked me on Twitter, so you can trade Tyus Howard for a third-round pick. Charlie Heck, you know, he can stay on as a swing tackle, but he can't be in the starting roster anymore. Give me a whole new offensive line. Give me what the Chargers did this past offseason to rebuild their entire offensive line offseason and not have it like crush their entire resources or liquidate their entire future to do so. That's what I want. I want a good offensive line next year. And if I can get a team that, you know, run blocks well and is able to run one run play well, that's all I care about at this point. Like, I'm just like watching the Rams offensive line today. Just, it was a lot of fun. Like, I'm very happy for them. And it's crazy they take, you know, David Edwards in the sixth round. He's the success that he is. And Whitworth's out, and they've no Bloom out there at left tackle, and they don't have to worry at all whatsoever. And they're starting, you know, their center who weighs like 275 pounds, and he's locking up Christian Kirk in the second level without any problems. And they lose Roger Saffold, and it doesn't matter. And Rob Havenstein's still a baller. And Corbett, like, gets benched and comes back in certain games and always has success too. And so I just want to watch the offensive line again. And, after all these years and the past few years and all the investment, the coaching changes, it's still bad. And like, it's just time to get new players there at that position. If I can get that, I'd be fine with a lot of everything else, you know? So that's our week 9 mailbag episode. And we did have one more question, and it was, what game should I watch next week to not have to deal with any of this dirge from last week again for the Texans? And so we do have a preview podcast every single week with my good friend Taylor and I. My own personal favorite game this week is going to be Cincinnati-Cleveland. And I say this because Cleveland cannot tackle at all whatsoever. That was kind of the questions about their defense with, you know, a lot of the speed that they have, but they couldn't really tackle that well, especially in the secondary. Like, Delpit's been a bad tackler, replacing John Johnson. Both their corners haven't tackled very well, including Newsome. You know, Greedy hasn't tackled that great. Anthony Walker's had, you know, he's been a good tackler, but he still has had some misses sometimes there too. But just in the secondary, they can't tackle. They're playing against a quick passing team for the Chiefs that, you know, likes to throw screens, especially to Ozuma. They like to throw use screens to Mixon as well too. And it's kind of like a must-win game for Cleveland, where they've gone from Super Bowl contender week one against the Chiefs to having Baker get hurt, and also just like Baker being an offense where if it's not open for him, he's not hitting it, and his pocket presence has been bad, and everything has to be designed for him too. They're like, if the Browns make the playoffs this year, they could move on from Baker, and maybe they're in the Watson sweepstakes if he agrees to a trade there too. Maybe they trade up and take a quarterback as well next year. So I think like at Cleveland 3-5, that probably kills it for them. And I can't believe they're going to allow Pittsburgh to come back and make a playoff run or sneak into the playoffs maybe too after losing to them last week. But I do think like just watching Cincinnati's defense play as well as it has and actually have the talent to match the scheme and how much fun their linebacking's play been with a bunch of young players in those positions. Watching Reader go up against Cleveland's offensive line's been a lot of fun too. And just like watching him by tackling the Chubb's going to be good. But I think it's a must-win game for Cleveland. And there really just isn't like a lot of great games this week at all either. That without Jameis Winston's voodoo and the injury problems for Arizona and San Francisco and Derrick Henry not being there for Los Angeles, this is kind of the best game that we have this week, unless you want to have like fun watching Carson Wentz throw interceptions against the New York Jets. But anyways, watch Cleveland-Cincinnati. Listen to the preview show on Friday morning. Until next time, I'm Matt Weston. Thank you for listening to Battle Road Radio. And thank you for, I guess, being on tonight.
That sounded good to me.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.